LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Available at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I forced myself on my guest, Justin Bartha. In 2010, saw him in a restaurant and had to tell him how great I thought he was and lend me a tenor, which he was doing at that point. And that same year, he had a movie played at the Sundance Film Festival, Holy Rollers, in which he gives a really terrifically funny and scarily intense performance. You, of course, have seen him in the interim in the Hangover films. His newest film as actor is White Girl. First of all, thanks so much for doing this.
Elvis, really, thank you so much. I mean, I haven't seen you in a long time, and I have wanted to see you, and this is an honor, so thank you for having me. You think I'm joking. I'm not joking.
I think you're joking.
I really,
he's from Detroit,
I'm
so he's
not
a low threshold for honor, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
But I'm going to ask you how you got involved in this, because I guess this is certainly one of the most provocative titles of a movie in the last 20 years.
Yeah, for sure. I got sent the script in the usual way that projects come to me. Another actor fell out, and so they're like, who can we get in a short period of time? So the agent sent me the script, and I read it, and it was, the title is provocative, but the whole entire script is, it's pretty provocative in a personal way, and it was so original. I hadn't really read anything that personal and that provocative in a long time. So once I met with the director, Elizabeth, and saw that
Elizabeth Wood,
who, this is her first narrative feature. And once I met with her, and you could just tell how it was actually based on a lot of personal events in her life and how clear her point of view and strong her personality was. It was kind of a no-brainer.
What's interesting is it's about a kind of New York that it feels like it could be a 70s film, or it could be an 80s film, or it could be a 90s film. It's a film about New York that in a way has never really gone away, has it?
Yeah, I mean, for me, that was one of the huge selling points, because I moved to New York City in 96.
To go to school, right?
To go to school. And it was also this time where I was discovering this independent cinema that I had never really been privy to in Detroit, where we're kind of both from. And so I was an intern at Independent Pictures with Kerry Woods, who produced Kids. So I was really, and I was such a fan of—
You were an intern? An office intern?
I was his assistant for a little while, and I was an intern there. And Harmony Korine used to come into the office, and I
was that his crazy period?
Yes, okay. Yes, for sure. And I was obsessed with him. I was obsessed with his films. I loved Kids and Julian Donkey Boy and everything he made, Gummo. And then also there was like that Dogma Manifesto that came out then. And as a film student at NYU, when these kind of a new almost genre of film come out, you know, it's like in your formative years, it just becomes the greatest thing ever. So this movie, White Girl, reminded me of those type of films. And it just so happened to be produced by Christine Vachon.
Who produced Kids,
yeah. And Elizabeth also will tell you, Elizabeth Wood, the director, will tell you that Kids was a huge influence on her also.
Yeah, I heard her talking about that at Sundance, where the film first played. For the audience who doesn't know anything except for the title, tell them what the movie's about.
The movie is about a white girl that moves to Queens in her second year of college, getting like a liberal arts degree. And she falls for a young drug dealer in her neighborhood, and also has an internship at an arts and cultures magazine.
What's the name of the magazine where you work?
The magazine is called Bad Magazine. it's on the nose, just like the title, which leads me to the second meaning of the title, White Girl, which is cocaine, which is kind of a street slang for cocaine. So she starts dating a coke dealer who is not a drug user. He's a Latin kid that is not a drug user.
But he's very specific about telling her to not
Right, exactly. But he does sell out of necessity for, you know, his sick grandmother. You know, it's a very grounded portrayal. And then they become involved, and he gets busted, and she has to sell his stash to get him out.
And it's interesting, too, because the white girl, but a lot of the white guys in the movie basically treat this character, played by Morgan Saylor, as prey. I mean, they're kind of predators in their way, aren't they?
I think yes is the short answer, but I think the long answer is that, you know, one of the main themes of the movie is white privilege. And I think that the two main white guys in the movie, myself and Chris Noth, who plays a kind of a sleazy lawyer, it is, I think, one of the main themes of the movie is your awareness of your own white privilege. So I can speak for my character, who's an editor of a arts and culture magazine, similar to kind of, you know, if you're familiar with that world, similar to...
Paper, one of those kinds of magazines.
Well, yeah, I was thinking like Purple Magazine, Olivier Zahn.
Oh, you think it's that glossy?
I think the character probably would love to... fashions himself as maybe like an American version of that French kind of magazine.
But even we get to see how corrupt he is because he's buying arts that he can promote in the magazine so the prices can go up. So
yeah, but I mean, then there's also, I mean, to circle back to your question or to the statement that he's a predator, I think that, it depends on his awareness of his own power and privilege. I think he definitely uses his own power, but I also think it is the way of the world. I think it's definitely – he's accepted the world as is instead of trying to change it for the better. He's manipulating and abusing his power.
No, because I actually found myself thinking about Holy Rollers as I was watching it. There's a similar intensity that these guys both have, and they're both – and I wanted to ask you about this a little bit because these are guys you played who are both about appetites.
Mm-hmm.
And almost want to consume whatever is in front of them. And there's almost kind of a glee that both these guys take in being a little juvenile.
Yeah.
And I wonder that you clearly got a kick out of playing this kind of stuff, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a freedom when you're playing, you know, kind of a more colorful character that could be seen as a bad guy. I mean, there is that connection to that childish part of you, that sense of play, that anything is possible, the boundaries are more limitless, and you know there aren't repercussions to your actions as much as if you live within, you know, the walls of being a good person or having to be socially acceptable in a sense.
These are both guys who almost sort of take some pleasure in being outside of being on the margins, placing themselves on the margins of mainstream behavior, aren't they?
Yeah, and they can provoke. The idea to provoke, I think, is the main action there. There is a sense that even if it's just a reaction from someone, to be able to change someone else's walk, to be able to look at someone and be with someone else and change them in a way that they would not have necessarily been, even if it's a minute kind of detail or if it's an overall a bigger change – I think that there's a pleasure in that because it's a more specific action to play, and it's a lot more fun because you're trying to strike a reaction in the other actor that they wouldn't usually have. There's no rules at all.
But there's also this line, too, when you're playing this kind of thing, and I just think about it because I really, having seen you on stage, where you can't be too big on stage. You can be a little bit bigger because you're putting out into a much bigger space. But you playing these guys, both White Girl and Holy Rollers, who are both bigger than life, but if you're playing it too big, it becomes overt comedy rather than realistic, doesn't it?
Yeah, and playing with the awareness is the fun of it too. And also, you know, even if you compare it to kind of the more broad, you know, like the Hangover movies or a character that is more reactionary to the world around him, these characters create their own little bubble and they live comfortably within a privileged bubble. And then they can... instead of just reacting to the world, they are creating the world. So the comedy comes more, you know, there is some levity to the characters too. They're not just dark, you know, evil guys, but the comedy comes from how they can exist in this privileged way and still seem human and not be, you know...
caricatures.
Yeah, not be caricatures and not... the variations of awareness of their own privilege and power, I think, can be really hilarious, I think, when it comes to if you play it real. Of course, you're going to play it real, yeah.
Yeah, but there's, I mean, you can, there are any number of ways, obviously, but I'm just struck because, again, your character, Holly Rosenbike, who's had a very proud guy who was always kind of trying to plant himself in the middle of situations, and your character here is almost somebody who never looks at anybody he's talking to.
Right.
He's in this, his own head so much, gauging what's going on, it gets back to that bubble you were talking about. He really seems to be almost like inside of a this structure built around him. People will have to permeate to get to him rather than him reaching out to people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a chess match where you've built and designed your own board. Instead of being playing chess in the real world, where you have to think of other people's feelings and their existence and how you're affecting them, I think what we're talking about is a lack of empathy. I mean, I think there's just, you know, there's a lack of empathy, and there is not apathy. It's not replaced by apathy, which I think is, you know, in the real world, some people that aren't empathetic are just don't give a about other people. These characters, they have a lack of empathy, I think, but they also enjoy creating that chessboard in a very insular way.
Because I guess I was asking this, I'm just wondering when you get offered characters like this, because you've often played a lot of guys who sort of the common sense, I mean, the national treasure.
The audience is going to have no idea what we're talking about because these are movies that are so small. And
we're talking about the big ones then.
Yeah,
National Treasure or the Hangover movie. You're basically sort of the common sense linchpin of these movies. And so these are just two kind of wild extremes that you go to.
Yeah, I mean, I identify with all of these extremes personally. I mean, I think that I'm more attracted, you know, kind of the smaller movies or the theater work that I do tends to have these darker shades in it, which I struggle with myself, of course. And I mean, I struggle with empathy. I struggle with my own empathy in life and being aware of how I'm affecting everyone and making sure that I'm not being apathetic. And then I'm also aware of, you know, linking it to kind of the bigger, kind of the Hangover franchise or kind of the more mainstream work that I've done. It's like I also am aware of an ideal that I have or a way that I can be a better person. And I can, it almost allows me to try out certain ideals on these characters and to see if those fit into the story and how they fit into the story. I mean, I just so happen to be in those movies, you know, and yeah, I think I look like a nice guy, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure.
Well, I think you do. We'll take a break. We're talking about empathy with an actor. My guest, Justin Bartha. He's one of the stars of the film White Girl. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm talking to my old friend Justin Bartha. He's one of the stars of the film White Girl, which played Sundance and got a really interesting reaction.
Yeah.
And I think back to the reaction that Holy Rollers got, or maybe even the first Hangover film. These are all films, again, these are kind of sybaritic characters. You talk about lack of empathy. At some point, these are all films about characters who just don't know how to behave as adults.
Right, yeah.
And there's an expectation of what adult behavior is, especially when so many of these people are kind of solidly middle-class citizens. And there's a kind of an archetypal middle-class white person we think about. So seeing this kind of behavior in these contexts has been completely fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I think it's just they're a lot of it is kind of becoming aware of their own, you know, power and their own place within I'm talking about White Girl or Holy Rollers right now, but yeah, I mean, even The Hangover, I mean, there is a sense that and that title, I always thought that title was provocative too, because there is a sense that it's like a post-Bush era hangover to like, what have we done? And now we have to figure out how to clean it all up. So, you know, there is a sense of, you know, white guys screwing things up and then having to figure out and then becoming either aware of their screw ups and trying to clean up the mess or, you know, just moving on and not changing from it.
Okay, I guess I just use the word sort of hunger because, I mean, even Holy Rollers is a provocative title because these aren't old-fashioned. These are just basically holy ballers. You know,
right.
These guys are rolling. They're drug dealers. And this idea of at some point in each of these films, the world changes at night.
Yeah.
The world becomes a really terrifying place at night in all three of these movies.
Yeah,
it?
I mean, I think it's the time where these characters take advantage of their own power and also it's to go back to the predator theme, it's when other people are asleep or unaware, they can then move in a more stealth fashion.
Because I was thinking about, there's a scene in, weirdly, one night on Cinemax, they ran this strange director's cut of Hangover. And there's a
really?
Scene, yeah, well, there's a scene where you're talking to Zach after Jeffrey Tambor just been in the room with him. That's not in the release version of the movie.
I've seen this, yeah.
But you're really trying to understand him, and you can see the limits of your patience being completely this thing you're talking about.
Right.
This guy working to try to be the best version of himself he can be, and because it's in the release version of the film, we get a sense of some innocence. But in this one scene in his room,
yeah,
he's going around in his underwear. You just kind of go, this guy is just like this unchecked impulse, and there's something. It's almost like a horror film. That one scene.
Yeah, yeah. I mean the Doug character. For me, it was always trying to figure out the common bond of communication between all the other main characters. Why would these guys be friends? And especially in the first movie. It's like he is the common bond, and once you lose that common bond, all hell breaks loose. So
that's why I said, though, common sense linchpin, because you were also a character in the National Treasure films, too. The one person who's trying to sort of find where the connective tissue is.
Yeah. I mean, I think the audience surrogate, however you want to, the National Treasure supposedly, I mean, National Treasure definitely is kind of, I always saw that guy as, I always pictured Purple Rose of Cairo for some reason for that movie, like Jeff Daniels.
Sure.
Just because it felt like he was always coming off of the screen. I always pictured him coming off of the screen and living in two different worlds. How bizarre it was to be in an action-adventure movie with Nicolas Cage and playing the sidekick character, which we had seen so many times in countless other action-adventure movies. So there was
awareness.
What's that?
There's an awareness.
Yeah, an awareness to it that I think could be seen as the worst thing you could do as an actor for a performance. But
I thought
I went with
I thought it was kind of interesting because it becomes a way to find comedy in something that's
exactly,
essentially belaying exposition.
Yeah, because essentially for that character in those movies, like everything you're doing is ridiculous. Every single thing. So you could, you know, and to go back to kind of a childish aspect. Like I felt like, you know, the class clown in middle school where you're commenting on everything around you because I think that's the audience surrogate part. I think everyone can identify with that. But yeah, there is an over-awareness to that character that I think if there is any connection to this white girl movie, there is an under-awareness to him that I think serves him.
That's what I was saying before in the first half about these extremes in these.
Yeah.
Is one or the other. And,
yeah.
And I guess part of the challenge for you has to be, and it's interesting because I didn't know you like had a production mind at all. And just sort of watching these films from the outside, did you find yourself, like when you were working with Carrie, just sort of thinking, well, figuring out the points of view of the characters as these movies were being made, did that just help you make sense of the films as they were being produced?
I always try to look at the micro and the macro. I can't help but look at the macro. I mean, when I first went to New York, I worked on every part of a movie because I didn't have any experience doing it. So for me, that's part of the joy in creating a character is understanding the whole chessboard, if you will, understanding the whole world, not just the one piece that you're playing, because the story always The story provokes the character, and the character provokes the story. It pushes each other along. So yeah, I've always kind of looked at, but I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I love doing both.
Is that an easier way to act, knowing the whole picture? Because I've talked to actors who just say that for them it's easiest and safest to just sort of know what it is they're doing, because they want to feel like they're entering into this thing. So the idea of having, you know, as they say about Irving Thalberg, the whole equation of pictures in your head, that becomes a little maddening and
yeah,
and
it
difficult.
Definitely becomes maddening. It's probably not the best way of working. But and I have, you know, when I was younger, I definitely annoyed some directors with or people that I was working with trying to understand every piece of the picture. And as I've gotten older, I've let go of that and held it in and just done it myself. But I don't know. I mean, I've heard, you know, I've heard actors doing both. For me, I just can't help it because there's clues within the story. I mean, you have the privilege of page, you know, the first page and the last page. So you know that world. And for me, I want to expand the world as far past those pages as possible. I don't want it to just be contained within that. I want to know... You know, I want to know every minute of the character's life before, so that it can inform all of the minutes during. And I think that there's clues to be had, not to, you know, it's almost like my life is National Treasure now. I'm trying to find these treasures. I just figured out why that movie's so important to me. Yeah, I try to find the Declaration of Independence in every, But it probably isn't a good idea, but it's like what I have nothing else to do, man. I mean, you know, why not obsess over everything and drive yourself nuts and, you know.
It's the treatment. The man sitting across from me with way too much information is Justin Bartha. He's one of the stars of the film White Girl. What was the first film that you saw that did that for you as an audience member? Made you think,
You know, as your tastes change. I mean, when I was a kid, it was like I was obsessed with horror movies. And it's like...
what kind of horror?
Well, Nightmare on Elm... Everything, from The Shining to Nightmare on Elm Street. But if you... I was talking about The Shining today, and I talk about The Shining often. From the first time you meet before they get to the Overlook Hotel, you sense that there is marital strife, that their life is not turning out the way that they want it, and that this journey is not is just the middle. It's not the beginning. It's not the end, even though the end of the picture, obviously, is the end. There's so much life before the movie starts. And that Nicholson in that movie, I always think of that. So that figuring out what is the overall motivation before the movie starts of this character, I think is always interesting. And how that falls into the scope of the film informs the choices you make in the micro aspects of the movie. But the first one that I remember, I mean, I would say maybe The Shining. I mean, maybe like these horror movies that kind of stand the test of time.
How old were you when you saw The Shining? Were you a kid?
I mean, I think I was like, I was 14. And then, you know, and then as you know, I know we've talked a lot when we used to hang out about kind of those great neorealist Italian movies that, you know, they blew my mind because it's the bigger themes are all compressed into these characters that I never saw before.
There's also a kind of social realism in those films
that
really informs a lot of the, well, if we look at, because I think certainly Todd, who's done the show a few times, to talk about that being a part of what The Hangover, very specifically the first one was, as you were saying, but also in Holy Rollers and White Girl too. I mean, that sort of sense of there's one thing happening on screen, but there's very much a part of the real world. I mean, there's no attempt to sort of pretend that the world doesn't exist outside the boundaries of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, of course, everyone's going for fully fleshed out characters and a fully fleshed out story, but there is a sense of not just the film being about something bigger, but also the character within the film represents something. And that is, for me, I sometimes use that as a jumping off point to whittle down to those moments that you can get to. So instead of, you know, it just helps me get to the as specific as possible, to maybe start as big as possible.
But I know from our early conversations then that you also are a writer too, that you think of these in terms of a narrative that makes sense to you. I mean, it's got to work for you on a narrative level as an audience as much as an actor.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I try not to get, as an actor, get mired down by the narrative, because I think human beings are what we started this interview kind of talking about is characters that are unpredictable. I think that if you get mired down in the narrative, like, you know, there are some moments that are exciting possibly could get tampered down. But for me, it's just understanding why the character is doing everything that they're doing, and then if it's logical, if it makes sense within any type of world, the world that it's created, the world that the director or the writer created, it has to make sense. It has to, it has to drive not just the character but the story. There shouldn't be wasted moments, in a sense.
I'm going to ask you as a last question what you thought of the movie after you saw it for the first time, seeing the kind of enormous impact this character has in these really sort of discrete inside of a bubble moments.
When I saw it at Sundance, I mean, I was torn in a sense. Interesting, because it is a provocative movie that hopefully will get mixed reactions and strike a conversation. But the first thing I thought was I was immensely proud of it. I mean, I think it's an accomplishment what Elizabeth Wood has done to make a small movie like this that does tackle huge overarching themes in a subtle way that does not hit you over the head. But I also was torn in that I was sitting near Morgan Saylor, who plays the white girl, Leah, in the movie. And I think it was the first time she had seen her amazing performance in front of such a big audience. And she's so different than what she portrays. And she's, a young woman that's incredibly intelligent and sensitive, that I think the way that she is the journey that she goes on is intense, and I think that being the figure of at the top of the social hierarchy of white male privilege, I think there was a huge sense of guilt that came over me, like wanting to make sure she was okay, and almost seeing her for the first time, because we shot the movie in a small amount of time in New York, and everyone kind of came. There wasn't a lot of pleasantries when it came to me coming on set. I didn't rehearse a lot. I just came in and was the guy and then left and hadn't really spent a lot of time with the real people. So seeing how affected she was by what was going on, and almost like, the audience was almost their mouths were agape at what they saw, in a sense. So it was an awareness of her own power that she saw up there that was pretty profound.
And we're out of time. I'm so sorry, but thank you so much.
Talk so much. I'm sorry.
No, that's why this is here. So yeah. I get to let you talk.
I love hearing you talk too.
You know better than that. My guest is Justin Bartha. He's one of the stars of the film White Girl, a recording engineer here at NPR West, as Leo DeLagula. The show is mixed by Kat Yoris, edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. No white privilege around here. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.